Hello, you're listening to FlixWise Canada. I'm Martin Kestler, or am I? Possibly I'm just here speaking with myself. Oh no, wait, I'm joined by Jacob Rivera. Hello, Jacob, thank you for joining me.
Hello, great to be here.
So I'm curious, what's in the box?
What's in the box?
What's in the box?
We don't know. Well, we're gonna unveil that later, I think. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. We'll be discussing the films of David Fincher, specifically his 90s films. I think we might have to have a follow-up episode about his later films at some point. But for now, we'll just talk about Alien 3, 7, The Game, and Fight Club. Because I think that's plenty of film to talk about. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, it's plenty of a box to unwrap.
So how were you first introduced to David Fincher?
I was probably first introduced to David Fincher through his commercial work, but this is before the boom of the internet, right? So, you know, you weren't able to look up who directed what. And so I had seen a couple of his commercials and then later on his videos that he did, like for Madonna and others.
Fantastic videos. And how did you first sort of become aware of him as a director you were interested in?
I would say, so I did see Alien 3 in the theater, but it wasn't until, again, I didn't associate, that was his debut film, and I didn't associate that with the man, David Fincher, but when 7 came out and I went and saw that in the theater, it just totally blew me away. And then he became someone that I connected to, you know, Alien, and then his other films. So he became one of those kind of styles and in the 90s, just one of my favorite films.
Yeah, I think Alien 3 is probably where I was introduced to him, too. I think, like, all those films, being a fan of that franchise, it sort of made me interested in who made them and made me want to learn more about film as a child. So I think that's how I first became aware of David Fincher. And that's one that's a little bit unusual in that he distance himself from the final product. Very hardcore David Fincher fans will kind of say, well, that's not really his vision. They took it away in editing. It's not really his film. I think David Fincher himself would probably say that.
Yeah, he might. But I think really when you look at it, you know, we would all like to have a career where we don't may have any missteps. But I think it was important to David Fincher's career, one, for dealing with the movie industry and when, you know, how it is today, when you can have a vision and things that you want to see on screen or the story you want to tell, and then the studios or things not going in your, you know, kind of way. And it should be kind of a learning lesson. I kind of, you know, associate this with my own life. You know, like I say, I don't regret really anything that's happened in my life because, you know, even the mistakes or the opportunities that I miss have led me to who I am today. And, you know, so I think that was a big lesson for David Fincher, and it helped him grow and, you know, kind of be able to become distinct with that style, even though he probably doesn't want to associate with that movie.
I mean, he was really young being thrown into such a big kind of mess of a production. There were several directors before him that were attached, and the script was still being rewritten while they were filming. So, like, I think that's a very difficult situation to be in. And I think, like, really looking back at Alien 3, the direction, I think, is probably one of the strongest aspects of it. For me, like, a lot of its shortcomings have more to do with the screenplay, the story. I think some of the characterizations feel a little bit thinly drawn for what should feel like a more of a character piece, where you have all these prisoners trapped together, all these fantastic actors, and I always found it a little bit disappointing that you never really get to know most of them. Some of them you do, like the Charles Dance character, I think is really interesting, but he's killed off halfway through the film. And the rest, yeah. I always sort of got a little bit confused, or like now less so, but at the time, certainly, like all these men with shaved heads running around, it was a little bit hard to distinguish one from another.
Right. And I think, you know, to be fair, you know, it is his first film. Like you said, he was young, but it's a completely uphill challenge or battle, because he's having to follow the great, you know, Alien by Ridley Scott, and then James Cameron, who took it into kind of an action sequel, sci-fi action sequel, and that was a great film too. You know, you know, some of my favorites. So it's kind of like, you know, the bar was set so high, so it's almost like you can do nothing but disappoint. Even if Alien was able to go in a different way, I don't really see it coming out, you know, favorable for him. And, you know, for all its flaws that Alien 3 has, I still really enjoyed it. I remember seeing it in the theater and, you know, being engaged. Is there, you know, again, is there shortcomings? Yes. And there's some interesting things, like I think in the quadrilogy. Yeah. There were some interesting stories. Like, it was supposed to be set, one of the stories was that it was supposed to be set like on a wooden planet, which I thought was like an interesting concept. Oh, I really love that.
The Vincent Ward vision, which I don't, right. I'm a big fan of On the Silver Globe and Hard to Be a God and those types of science fiction stories. So I kind of wish it had, the Alien franchise had gone in that direction. I always think that's maybe one of the great unmade science fiction films was the Vincent Ward version of Alien 3. But as is, I still think like there's enough to distinguish itself, especially when I think like at the time, because of Alien's commercial success, it would have been sort of easy to try and imitate that in a very obvious way. I like that, you know, maybe to the dismay of fans, it kills off beloved characters and it sort of fights to have its own identity as a film. I think that's one aspect that's strong in Alien 3 is its distinct nature. You know, that's one thing I loved in general about the Alien films is each one sort of has its own flavor, even though it's the same basic elements. It's Sigourney Weaver and the monster, and each film,
yeah, definitely,
you know, it's in the details, in the direction, and things like that that make them unique. You know, and the big killing off of the beloved Newt and Hicks characters and Bishop character, you know, it's all very uncomfortable, but I thought it was quite powerful, actually, the sort of despair you get because of your attachment to those characters and how it makes you feel about Ripley's progression as a character and where she is at her life. So, like, I do think it's a worthwhile film, even though, you know, you can maybe say it's weaker than its predecessors.
Right. And you know, another interesting thing I thought about Alien 3 is, you know, you go from something like Alien and then Aliens, which dealt with a lot of kind of like, you know, where they have all these weapons and whatnot. But in Alien 3, they basically have no weapons. And it's almost like they have to figure out a way, like a mouse going through a maze. You know, the way they use the different tunnels and you know, setting a trap, trying to get it into that, was it the boiling...
the leadworks, yeah.
Yeah, leadworks, exactly. And so, you know, I think that you know, again, having a distinct kind of story and style to set it apart, and the things you mentioned before by killing off main characters, or you know, kind of, you know, often in movies people don't, you know, raise the stakes. So, for example, like, you know, like a Marvel movie or something, you know, Captain America isn't going to die at the end of the movie, and so, you know, making the choices like this, like bold choices, you know, kind of get me a little bit more vested into something because they're taking risks.
Right. His follow-up film, Fincher's follow-up film, was Seven. And that's probably a film I'd say takes some risks, don't you think?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I'm probably going to gush too much about it on this episode, but I love Seven. Like, I love it so much. It's one of my favorite films. Again, spoiler alert, you know, I like the risks that they take in this movie. You know, one, you know, taking a person like Brad Pitt, who was kind of coming off, I believe, like the Legends of the Fall and kind of like the heartthrob. And then, you know, and he had like kind of the golden locks of hair. And then they just kind of roughed him up a little bit, you know, cut his hair. You know, he, you know, plays a, you know, detective, a young up and coming kind of cocky detective. And, you know, you have the Morgan Freeman character. And really in this movie, what I like about it so much is that the villain wins in the end. The villain gets what he wants. And you don't see that often in movies. You know, I imagine these movies go through audience test screenings and whatnot, and they're like, you know, ah, that's a little too dark, or, you know, that's, you know, I want this guy to, you know, catch the killer and walk away, you know, and live to fight another day. But it's really a psychological, great, dark, you know, tense movie. I can't say enough about it.
It's interesting you say that the villain wins. I think even though that character gets what he wants in the end, the very end, it doesn't leave you with this total feeling of bleakness, because I think there's this story thread going along about Morgan Freeman's character retiring. And I think that very end where the police chief played by Lee Army, when he says, like, oh, are you going to be around? And Morgan Freeman's character says, yeah, like, I'll be around. For me, that was sort of him saying that, like, he's not going to retire. And that final narration where he mentions the Ernest Hemingway quote that the world is a fine place and worth fighting for. I agree with the second part that little bit of narration he gives. To me, I think, like, it's sort of about somebody who looks at the dark of the world, but he ultimately is not broken by it. He's going to keep fighting. You know, he might be cynical, but he's not defeated by it at the end. So, like, I thought that was kind of interesting. Do you feel that maybe, like, the Morgan Freeman character is more the main character, or do you follow Brad Pitt more in the film?
No, I definitely think Morgan Freeman. It's really is about Morgan Freeman, mm-hmm. and him dealing with this young partner and being, you know, he happens to be, you know, close to retirement and walking away, and this case kind of falls on his lap, and he wants to kind of detach from it, but he almost can't, because he sees this, you know, young detective, you know, eager. He's not
quite up to it. Yeah.
Yeah. And, but he, you know, he kind of wants to help him. You know, he goes to the library and he's like, you know, doing like little things. And then even there's a really powerful scene where Gwyneth Paltrow, who plays David Mills, who's Brad Pitt's wife, she basically reveals to him a secret that she hasn't even told her husband. So all these stories are interconnected to the main character, which I agree with you is a Somerset, Morgan Freeman's character. So it definitely is about that. But to kind of speak on why I think the killer kind of wins in the end, like, I think, you know, the John Doe character, him trying to complete this kind of task of the seven deadly sins, Morgan Freeman's, you know, the, you know, seasoned detective, and you know, you're not going to shake him up, really. Mm-hmm. But you basically destroyed the lives of this young couple, and in a way, kind of chip away at Morgan Freeman, because I agree with you. The assumption is that he's not going to retire. He's going to keep on, you know, fighting mm-hmm. on. But for the happy ending for Morgan Freeman, you know, what does this do to somebody's, you know, psyche? And, hey, I'm about to retire. I'm about to leave this behind. And I'm going to, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm going to go retire, or, you know.
What do you think of the visual style? Because it seems like, even though Alien 3 was his first film, like, 7's the one that really, I think, got the idea of David Fincher's visual style out there. And that was one of the things that I think was most imitated from 7. I've seen a lot of films trying to go for that aesthetic, or especially like the opening titles. Right. I think later on we might have to talk about the opening titles for each of these films, but I've right. seen that imitated many times. And what do you think it is about that visual style that sort of made the film feel unique? Or
I think, you know, for me, it was at that time I hadn't seen anything kind of like that dark, or that, like, real, in the sense of, like, kind of rubbed in dirt and gritty. You know, a lot of the films that I can remember from the 90s, you know, prior to this point,
flat, like, kinda, even lighting, colorful. Right. Yeah.
Exactly. So, you know, he kind of just, it's very in your face and just saying, like, hey, we like to romanticize about cities and things like this, but this is like, you know, rains coming down on you and, you know, very dark tones and, you know, just this very kind of drabbiness to it.
Right.
So very, very distinct style. And I think that, you know, as his style has developed, he still has kind of held on to that kind of darkness or that edge.
Yeah. I thought it was a little bit funny that the cinematographer, it's the same cinematographer as Alien Resurrection. It's like David Fincher worked on Alien 3 and then he worked with the cinematographer of Alien Resurrection. So it actually has kind of a similar look to that film, I think, more than the third Alien. Seven looks a little bit like Alien Resurrection with those deep blacks and has kind of that chiaroscuro look to it, which I like. But
I think the Alien, you know, going back to Alien 3, I think the style to that, I always equate it to like almost like metallic. I think it kind of comes from his video style. I think industrial. I'm thinking like Nine Inch Nails, industrial, very metallic and almost like so thick you can touch it kind of thing. And then, you know, going to Seven, you know, it changes a little bit, but it is interesting that, you know, he did work with that cinematographer and that look of that film is very similar.
I feel like the gritty kind of look, that's one thing he's become sort of associated with, but his films have gotten, I think, increasingly sleek. Like his film after The Game, there's like some grit that eventually comes into it, but a large portion of the film, it's very, like you said, metallic and very clean, and, you know, it almost prefigures the look of his digital films. I don't know, it almost feels like it could have come later, The Game. Like that almost fits more into his post-90s work, I think, because especially when people think of Seven and Fight Club, that sort of grunginess, that dirtiness, The Game doesn't quite feel like that.
No, I agree. I think The Game feels almost like more refined, like it's been through a cleaning machine a little bit. You know, still has the dark tones and kind of what's lurking in the corner aspect, but it's definitely a lot, like, I think the word you use was sleek. It's a lot more refined. But again, The Game to me is another, you know, I did see that in the theater also, and it's another one of his movies that, you know, again, is it flawed? Yes, but it is one of those movies I enjoyed. I thought it was a nice thriller and with a good performances all around, and it doesn't, to me, it doesn't get the credit that it deserves.
Yeah, I think so, because like it feels like out of these films, like Alien 3 gets bolstered a bit by the Alien fan base, and Seven and Fight Club have a huge following, so The Game, I think, falls a little bit into the dust, but I really enjoy it, actually. I think it's really funny. You know, you can see some of David Fincher's humor coming through in The Game. All those films have little bits of humor.
Yeah, sort of like I was gonna
sense of humor. Yeah,
I was gonna say Seven. Even to me, Seven has a few funny scenes. Most notably, I think it's Army. Is it Army? Lee Army.
Yeah.
He's sitting at the desk and the phone keeps on ringing and he picks it up and he says, "This is not even my desk," and he just hangs it up. You know, it's kind of like a little comic relief. And I agree with you. I think the game has a few of those kind of quips back and forth. You know, he's kind of has that condescending talks with his brother, you know, kind of like, "What is it now?" You know, Conrad and you know, he's kind of in a way he's become his father.
And even though the whole premise has this dark psychological thriller, twisty kind of quality to it, it also is sort of a comic premise in that he's never really sure how much of it is just a game or if he's really in danger, even up to the very final sequence.
Right.
He's not sure if it's real or not. You know, when he thinks that he shoots his brother and that's why he jumps off. But I don't know. I like that kind of you know, less obvious sense of humor that comes through in some of it. And one bit in Alien 3 that always gets a laugh out of me, it's near the end. One of the prisoners, all they have for weapons, whatever they can scrounge up, one of them has a pair of scissors. and he's running around and he sort of bumps into another prisoner and he's like, you know, what are you doing running around with those out like that? You hold them like this and puts them so it's the handle outwards, right. Which, like, I always think it's funny. And Fight Club, like, that there's a lot of humor in Fight Club.
Ton of humor.
I think maybe even to the point where, like, some of the fan base might not realize that it's not taking things seriously. But
right.
People do kind of take Fight Club seriously even now. I know some people who, the way they talk about it, they think, like, Tyler Durden's the coolest, right?
Right. Yeah, and, you know, but again, I think the other part about the comedy of a Fight Club is that you're dealing with a source material from Chuck Palahniuk, and his novels and stories do have a lot of humor to it, and I think Fight Club, I think it came around at a time where people latched onto it, maybe for the wrong reasons.
Right.
Like you were saying before, and, you know, maybe missing the point of the movie itself.
Mm-hmm. Although, I think, like, sometimes the film doesn't work that hard to underscore that, like, yeah, this character's wrong, this is getting out of hand, this is nuts. I think it sort of leaves a little bit of the burden on the audience to say, yeah, this is out of hand, you know, and not everyone necessarily goes along with that. I don't know, but right. I don't know.
It's definitely become a cult classic in the sense that, you know, so many people, I think, quote it and, you know, kind of associate with it. Like you were saying, you know, it's cool or, like, you know, edgy, and I believe, you know, when it came out, it didn't get a good critical response, and it got a lot of backlash for the violence.
No, I think a poor commercial response as well. Yeah.
But again, it was another movie I saw in the theater, and again, at that point, I'm a, you know, David Fincher fan, after, you know, Seven and The Game and Alien 3, so, you know, I really liked the movie, I really liked the performances, and you know, it's become one of my kind of, you know, favorite movies. Although I haven't, you know, I don't watch it as much as I used to. And I tend to do that with movies because if you watch them too many times, it gets repetitive and it kind of loses it, you know, its punch. And so I like to have space between, you know, movies like that so that I can kind of, it's almost like I'm never going to be able to rewatch it for the first time again, but it's about as close as I can get, you know, when I give it some, like, air to breathe.
Sure. I also find, like, it's a film that the more distance I have from it, the more it seems rooted in a very sort of particular time. You know, there are things about it that I think probably appeal more to maybe the generation that's just, like, a bit older than me, like Gen Xers more than millennials, you know, things like, oh, you know, I hate my job and just wish I could quit and do that. Like, you know, I know so many people are like working unpaid internships or lucky to have a job, but that stuff, I think, doesn't quite have the same impact that it might have at the time, or definitely, like, living in an environment today where, you know, you do have bands of guys getting together and blowing stuff up, and it's not fun, you know, it does sort of suck some of the fun out of it, but I think, like, I could still sort of appreciate Fincher's formal playfulness. Like, I like the talking into camera and explaining the cigarette burns and splicing frames into the film and things like that sort of make it interesting, the explanations about some of these details, you know.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of playfulness to the movie, and again, going back to the source material of the book, you know, a lot of that's there too. But I, you know, I think, you know, both the actors, Edward Norton and Brad Pitt do, and also Helen Bonham Carter, they do a good job of kind of reveling in that, in the details, and kind of making it their own and kind of having fun with it. I think I'd listened to the commentary on it, and it sounds like they had a blast making it, and you know, it was nice. It was kind of neat to hear all their little comments that they had about, you know, this scene, you know, what the scene did and what that scene did. So, for any fans out there, check out the commentary.
I think, isn't the Fight Club DVD with like three commentaries or?
Multiple commentaries.
That was like the heyday of all the special features. Like that's kind of disappeared now.
Yeah,
that was still a time when you could have like three audio commentaries and like a whole second disc of interviews and making ofs. And actually, in general, like I was kind of like David Fincher's movies for having these like pretty packed home video releases. They usually do have extensive making of features, which I like.
I think Seven has I think if I'm not mistaken, the special edition of Seven has so the notebooks that John Doe writes in, I think they had like somebody like do a bunch of those or whatever. Like they actually had some notebooks, and I think there's like a feature where you can like look through them or something to that effect.
So it had like some production designer go through like you know, hundreds of pages. They had to write all these things so that when they flip through,
right,
you know, you could just see writing. So a lot of work went into what ends up being a fairly small detail on the film,
right?
And that was the basis for like the opening titles, that those like handwritten notes and things in the John Doe's apartment. And like that definitely, I think, set the tone of the film. And it's sort of interesting how each of these films, the opening titles sort of set the tone. I thought, yeah, like especially Alien 3, where you just have that first note from the lead out of the 20th Century Fox fanfare. It just kind of goes sour, and like you kind of feel your gut drop out. Like you just know right even before the film starts, you're in for a bad time. So I do kind of like when Fincher makes sure to add this little extra thing just to sort of set the mood or set the tone of the film before it really begins.
Right. Yeah. I mean, he's kind of become infamous with his title sequences, you know. And really, it's almost like a good story. You know, you're always looking for that hook. And I think he does a good job of getting me hooked into his movies by those beginning title sequences where I kind of like rub my hands together. And I can't, you know, I'm ready to dive into this, you know, this story or this visual.
I know, like, it's not one of his 90s films, but like the one that sort of disappointed me that felt like it just didn't live up to its title was the Girl with the Dragon Tattoo remake, where the opening title felt like a really like dark, almost James Bond style opening sequence, and I thought like, okay, like it's got the James Bond actor in it, like is this going to be David Fincher doing like his own like goth James Bond movie? And then like I think what it ends up being isn't that, but most of the time you do get a sense of what the film's going to be right from the get-go.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think Girl with the Dragon Tattoo is his weakest film, in my opinion. But that opening sequence, when I saw that in the theater, I was like blown away. You know, I think they have the a Led Zeppelin song playing in the background. It's
really incredible CGI. Black liquid pouring out and flowering.
Exactly.
People.
Yeah.
Things like that. But it looks very striking. He's somebody who uses special effects quite a bit. Like, I know he started off in visual effects when he was maybe even still a teenager. I think he was working on Return of the Jedi, or like maybe when he was 20 years old, something like that. So he's worked with special effects for a long time, and he always sort of inserts them into his films in unexpected places. The digital effects in Fight Club, for instance, you know, going into trash bins, or these impossible camera moves, that's something he's become sort of known for.
Yeah, even the opening credits for Fight Club is, you know, them going through the brain and like the
I like that, the neurons in the brain.
And then coming out of the out of the barrel of the gun that's connected to the mouth, and you know, kind of getting, you know, zooming out for perspective. But he worked at Industrial Light and Magic, and I think in the early 80s, and then, you know, he did work on film, the film that you talked about. So, and even some of his commercials, you know, like one of his, I think maybe his earliest commercial of the American Cancer Society, when he had the baby that's like smoking, and like a fetus smoking, you know, which is all, you know, visual.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, I mean, probably not all of it, but most of it, I think, still looks good today. Still holds up.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it holds up really well. Even a movie like Alien 3, where,
what surprised me is that the alien wasn't CGI at the end, because it kind of looks like it, but I found out, you know, when the special features and the DVDs finally come out, that like, oh, it's a rod puppet against a blue screen, which I thought was really kind of bizarre, but it was like a motion controlled camera to insert this rod puppet in, and I think like that, for whatever reason, doesn't look right. It doesn't really feel like it's a part of the scene. The lighting doesn't quite match. The Textronic kind of looks like it doesn't have the same sort of grain pattern, if that makes sense. Like it just sort of looks too smooth, and it's sort of too bad that special effect doesn't quite pan out. But
I mean, I think, again, yeah, if you consider it the time that, you know, in the 90s, early 90s, when it was done, you know, by today's standards, it's definitely not seamless. There's definitely like a little glow to the image that kind of, you know, doesn't match up with the, you know, the foreground or what have you. So, but, you know, at the time when I saw it, I thought it was kind of, you know, in the 90s, trying to, you know, erase from my mind all the advances that we made in visual effects. Right. I thought it was, you know, kind of, you know, really cool, and it had a nice look to it.
What still blows me away are the sets. Like, I couldn't believe that they really built these things that look so lived in. You know, I assumed like, oh, maybe they went to like real factories, or like found a real abattoir or places like that to film in. But they're sets. They're these like massively constructed sets. You know, the lead works. It wasn't a real location. It was all built. But it kind of feels so grounded that it's, I could believe it exists somewhere. And there's all these like details in the film that I like to kind of ground that sci-fi world. One of my favorites is the needle that the doctor character, played by Charles Dance, uses, has Swiss made written on it, which for some reason the idea of like Switzerland being in the distant future kind of just makes it feel more real that there's still Swiss made products. And I thought maybe it was also kind of an in-joke too about the alien itself being Swiss made by H.R. Giger, but and little things like that I find just add the right amount of a texture to kind of ground it, make it feel believable. So I like stuff like that.
Yeah, and you know, in his early life, Fincher did, and I think in his high school days, did direct plays and design sets. So, you know, I think what I like about Fincher is he kind of likes every aspect of film, and, you know, not just doing the directing, but also, you know, when it comes to effects or sets or even post-production, music, all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only thing that he doesn't do is write is probably the only thing that he doesn't do.
There is sort of this question whether David Fincher is a stylist or if he's like an actual artist, auteur, and that whatever he makes sort of depends on his scripts. But how do you feel about it?
No, I believe he's an auteur, and because it's just, I think you kind of know when you're watching a David Fincher film, regardless if you know what the source material is.
And do you see sort of recurring themes or motifs or ideas going through these four films, or do you think it's more just a stylistic continuum?
I mean, for me, it's, you know, if you go to Alien, it's kind of like this very dystopian, you know, future, and them running away from this or trying to get away from this alien. And then Seven, in a way, it's, again, very dark, and you know, I don't even think they'd say what type of city it is or what city it's actually set in. This is like an imaginary city, but again, there's this chase that's happening. And then with the game, you know, he's being chased. So I feel like there's always like this maybe theme of like being chased or chasing, mm-hmm. Where you're constantly like moving and trying to avoid all these pitfalls, almost like a video game.
It's interesting. And I think like there is sort of like a general, I don't know, cynicism of human beings that's kind of consistent through a lot of this.
Yeah, and you know what though? The one thing I could say about that is that, you know, I'm not a pessimistic person. I'm mm-hmm. a pretty jovial person, but I mean, even you know, in today's times, I mean, you look at like the things that are happening in the news, you know, just of recent. Mm-hmm. I hate to say it, but there's still a lot of like terrible evil out there. So, you know, occasionally you'll have somebody kind of shine a light on that, and I think, you know, people almost want to have like ignorance is bliss and kind of want to be numb and not have to deal with that. And just like, hey, I'm in my life and, you know, I don't want to be bothered by these outside things. But really it's part of the world. It's like, you know, a different side of the same coin, you know, the good and evil. And, mm-hmm. and some would say that evil can't even exist without good and vice versa, because how would you know it's evil unless you have something to compare it to that's, you know, that's good.
I mean, what would you say are the examples of goodness that come up through these films in Seven or Fight Club or The Game?
One of my favorite scenes of Seven is that it's kind of like a tender scene between Somerset and Tracy, played by Gwyneth Paltrow, where she's revealing to him the secret, and in turn, he reveals his secret. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
he talks about his longtime girlfriend having an abortion, right? And
Right.
And the way he phrases it, he says that, you know, he still feels like they made the right choice, but he doesn't have a day that goes by where he doesn't regret it. So, like, that's sort of the contradiction that I think comes up throughout Seven. It's this idea that, you know, you can do the right thing and still regret it, or, you know, the inverse of that is also maybe applicable depending on the point of view you take. But, you know, it's hard to have, like, this sort of optimistic feeling with that much melancholy, and especially knowing what happens to the Gwyneth Paltrow character with the aforementioned spoiler box.
Yeah. I mean, but, again, like, a scene like that, or even when they're in his apartment and they invite him over for dinner, and, you know, they're kind of listening to, you know, jazz music, and then I think the train goes by, and you know... He's like, what the hell is that? And he's like, oh, we came and looked at the place. You know, of course, they only show it at this time. And then we leave here the first night and the train goes by. And he has, you know, they all have a little good laugh about it. And she even asks about, you know, why isn't he married and you know, all this stuff. So, you know, there is lighter parts to it. I think, you know, he's showing, you know, that kind of to the point, the last quote in the movie, you know, the world's, you know, this, you know, maybe this bad place, but it's, you know, worth fighting for. Mm-hmm. And the then game, even in Fight Club.
Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, in the game, like it's sort of a story about, somebody who like you think maybe actually could change and improve as a person because of this experience. Like, I think, I always think Michael Douglas, he's very good at playing assholes. He's probably, you know, great person, nice person in real life, but I think he's sort of exceptionally good at playing these asshole characters, with the game being sort of like, you know, not so different from a Gordon Gekko type character, but you know,
that's why they call it acting.
Sort of by that, like, you know, the end, it's this sort of psychological healing by going through the motions of jumping off and dealing with the trauma of his father's death. You know, like it seems like that movie in some way it's all about healing something that was broken during childhood.
Yeah, I think the movie, to me, the word that comes to mind is redemption, you know. Mm-hmm. And again, I know the story, it's very kind of out there and like, you know, oh, how can that happen, you know, so many things have to fall into place. Right. But if you take it for what it is, it's a movie, you know, don't associate it with like, oh, this couldn't really happen in real life. But he goes through, you know, he's become this hardened person and a hardened man, Even, you know, when he's dealing with his, I think his like maid or house caretaker, he's very kind of short and curt with her and just, you know, very to the point. And, you know, and she, grew up with him like when he was a little kid and, you know, lived through that experience. At least that's the impression I get. But yeah. he, you know, his father, you know, commits suicide by jumping off the roof. I believe it's at his birthday even. And he, in a sense, he becomes his father, but he has this opportunity, you know, through the help of his brother, he has this opportunity to kind of see that, you know, life, it doesn't have to be this way and that there is like something beyond just having things and being alone and just, you know, kind of like you were saying before, an asshole. Yeah, but I mean, you know, so again, there's some positive hope there and a sense of redemption. And then in Fight Club, I think there's a scene where they go into the liquor store and they have I can't remember the guy's name, but they have him come out and he reads his license and he says, you know,
veterinarian.
Right. But he, you know, he says he's going to, you know, I'm going to kill you or whatever, but I know where, you know, I know you. I'm going to, if you don't do what you're supposed to do, you know, I'm going to come and find you. But then, you know, when Edward Norton's character says, you know, why'd you do that? You know, like that's you're crazy. You're nuts. And he's like, just think about it. This guy is going to potentially going to like every day is going to be like, you know, I could have been dead, but now I'm alive and I'm going to go do something. So to me, as crazy as that sounds, I think that's another kind of like positive thing to like kind of turn somebody's life around, even though that's an extreme example. But, you know, almost like a second chance.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the Edward Norton character in Fight Club, like it's sort of like he's drawn between these two forces. You have the Tyler Durden character, who's a product of his own mind, who's sort of leading him down this ultimately destructive path. You know, it's sort of breaking things down until it's going to destroy everything. And then the Marla character who sort of pulls him back from that. And he realizes that the Tyler character is going too far. But how do you think that dichotomy plays out in the Edward Norton character?
Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting. You know, I hadn't read the book and, you know, I just, you know, I didn't pick up on a lot of the kind of background where you see the Brad Pitt's character in certain scenes. But, you know, I'm thinking, you know, it's two separate people. And, mm-hmm. you know, you have the Marla Singa character, you know, kind of react in the way she does to Edward Norton's character. But, you know, in a way you don't know that, oh, well, he's treating her this way. And so it becomes this kind of this... how do you say a trilogy of relationships, but it's actually, you know, one-on-one.
Triumvirate or something. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like a love triangle. I mean, the love triangle aspect is sort of a little bit funny because like, I think in the book it's fairly explicit that the main character is gay. So like scenes from the book translated to the film, it changes the context a bit so that like when the Tyler character is off with Marla and the main character is jealous. Like in the book, it's a little bit more clear. Like he's jealous of Marla taking Tyler away from him. Right.
Right.
It's like, I think they're meeting. It's totally different than in the film. Like in the film, they meet on the airplane or actually like he's sort of introduced in these flash frames subliminally. But the first time they meet proper is on the airplane flight. But I think in the book they meet on a nude beach, if I'm remembering that right. Like it's totally different.
I think you're right.
Yeah. So like, I thought that was a little bit, I don't know, strange or I wasn't quite sure what to make of that. If it was just a change made to make the film more commercial in the 90s or I don't know. How do you feel about that?
I feel you are correct that in the 90s, you know, to make it, you know, I don't think it was, you know, the homosexuality aspects of it weren't, you know, maybe, how do you say, marketable at that time. So, but I do, you know, I do get a, when I watch it, what I read into the character is that he is jealous of the time, mm-hmm. with not so much that his, like, there's an attraction to Marla, but more so to the Brad Pitt character, Tyler Durden, because he just seems like he wants to be around him all the time. And even when he's doing crazy stuff, he can't, like, help himself to be, you know, drawn to him. And in a way, you know, like, Brad Pitt's, like, cut from stone in that movie. And, you know, he's got a, you know,
when he's kind doing, of like, magnetic Bruce Lee martial arts, you know.
Yeah, so, yeah. So I definitely feel the homosexual undertones there. Mm-hmm. But again, I think to your point, you know, at that time, it wasn't as prevalent as is now.
I mean, there's something a little bit funny, like, about some people who are a little bit, bro-ish, who are super into Fight Club, like, you know, getting into, like, oh yeah, it's all about, like, male bonding and macho stuff, and, like, there's this subtext they might not pick up on, but, the Helena Bonham Carter as Marla, I've probably said this on the podcast before, but this thing with her where, like, the less attractive Helena Bonham Carter should be, the more attractive I find her. She's smoking, and I don't usually like smoking, and some of the lighting, like, it makes her skin look almost like she has jaundice or something, and her hair's a mess, and for some reason I'm like, that's sexy. So
I agree with you, but I think, you know, David Fincher does a good job of how he films her. Even, like, you know, you're talking about the smoking, there's a scene where mm-hmm. she's kind of, like, smoking in slow motion and blowing smoke, yeah. And it is damn sexy. I mean, I don't think that's deniable. But she does look like a mess. She kind of looks like somebody, like an orphan from Oliver that was, you know, right. Drug off the street and you know. But I mean, you know, she.
I like
she
when does... she goes to the dry cleaners and she just picks up all these clothes and they're talking and you think, oh, she's just grabbing her stuff from the dry cleaners.
Her laundry.
Yeah, and it's not hers. And then she goes next door and sells it.
Yeah.
I don't know. I like that character.
I think Fight Club, out of these four movies that we're talking about, I think has the most humor mm-hmm. to it. But again, it has a lot of, like, you know, these different kind of twists to it. Not like a M. Night Shyamalan twist, but, like, you know, like a little bit more
that,
natural.
That was sort of like the age of the twist, how I think of it. Like, from the kind of mid-90s to the mid-2000s, there were a lot of films where you almost thought, like, okay, what's the twist going to be? It's got to have a twist. A film can't just be a story, you know? So, right. Like, even the idea that you're sort of meant to question the reality presented to you with the film, like, that seemed to be really popular at the time. You know, it came out right around the same time as The Matrix, and earlier there was Dark City, and there was Truman Show, and you know, I wondered why that was, that there were all these films about maybe questioning our own reality. And even aside from the idea that the Tyler Durden character is a figment, it's sort of questioning the main character's values, if all his possessions mean anything, if his job means anything, you know, if he should tear it down. And I think even though the film ultimately sort of wants you to say, like, no, that you can't just, like, destroy it and live with deer running through the skyscrapers and go back to, like, right. Caveman times, you know, of course not, but, like, it's not exactly clear where the film thinks that line should be drawn.
Yeah, I think that it does a smart thing in the sense that where it's leaving it up to the viewer, because I think what it's trying to show is that you kind of can't go all the way one way or the other, right? Yep. So you probably shouldn't be, you know, controlled by all these outside influences, and you're not really living, but at the same time you have to have a little bit of order, because a little bit, you know, when things are out of, you know, too much out of order, eventually that it's in a sense you're fighting yourselves. You're fighting yourself, which is what he's doing at the end. He's trying to pull away, but it's against himself. So, you know, I think, you know, at the end when you know, the spoiler alert again, if you haven't seen it, but you know, the bombs go off and like the financial, you know, you're seeing potentially a financial, you know, crisis happen with all the buildings falling, and he's holding hands with Marla, and he, you know, he says, you met me at a very strange time, I think something mm-hmm. to that effect. But you know, I don't think that he's going to go and continue his escapades of you know, anarchy and destruction. I think he's at that point, kind of in a hopeful way, he's going to try to like rebuild his life again.
Right. That's another change from the book. And I think even Chuck Palahniuk said he thinks the ending of the film is better than the book. So that might tell you something. So would you say that Seven is your favorite of these films?
Yeah. I at one point I thought it was Fight Club, but then I just can't. To me, Seven's like just a perfect film. It's one of those movies. To me, like the enjoyment I get out of like some of my favorite films are the films that I can watch over and over again, and they still pack the same, you know, kind of punch. And if I had to, you know, rank them, you know, I would probably definitely put Seven above Fight Club.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything specifically you think maybe sets it apart from Fight Club and the other two, or some of the later films even?
I think what it is that I think part of it's nostalgia, and this is a very tricky thing in film. I always have this problem because I'll see some older films, but I can't unsee everything that I've seen up to that point if I go back to an old film, and so it's hard to not compare it to other things. But up to that point, you know, I hadn't, you know, I had seen a bunch of films, you know, growing up, you know, I used to go to the movies, you know, a ton. But it just, it kind of, I don't, the story and the visual aspect and the acting, it just, it all seemed to come together for me. And I just really, and even though it's a dark kind of, you know, suspense movie, it just really held my attention all the way through, and I just loved it. And I think, you know, at that time in my life in the 90s, you know, I was very into film, and it just, it made me kind of see film in a different way. And then, you know, with Fight Club, you know, I like the comedy aspect probably the most of Fight Club. I just think that there's a lot of, you know, funny, you know, things about it. I would almost rank it as a comedy, more than a drama.
I think that's probably fair, actually. Yeah. Or, satire, I think you could call it.
Right.
Yeah. There were other similar films. Like, I think Seven was probably the most prominent out of the, like, post Silence of the Lambs wave of crime films. But like, and have you seen Jennifer 8?
With Uma Thurman and yeah. Andy Garcia?
Yeah.
You know what? I might have seen it once in, or maybe bits and pieces of it.
I was sort of curious if maybe that was a touchstone for Seven, because it came out in 1992. This, like, really dark kind of film noir, Conrad Hall cinematography. I don't know. If people haven't seen it who are listening, I think that's one that might be worth watching if you're a fan of Seven. I like Jennifer 8 quite a bit. But
yeah, I'll have to, you know, either rewatch it or watch it for the first time again. I sometimes get lost with the movies that I've seen, especially if I've only seen them once, because if it didn't leave, you know, as much of an impact on me, then I sometimes forget, you know, whether, you know, I've seen it or not. But I'll definitely put that on my list.
Cool. So is there anything you'd like to touch on that we didn't cover, or?
Nothing. I mean, I think, you know, it was probably smart to kind of unpack this with the 90s films and then his later films. I would just suggest that anybody hasn't seen a David Fincher film, maybe for the younger viewers out there, you know, search him out. And I think, you know, give him a chance. To me, he's one of my favorite, if not my favorite, filmmaker right now. And, you know, I'm really in love with his work, and I will continue to watch it.
Cool. Well, thank you, Jacob, so much for coming on and talking about David Fincher. And I'm going to be looking forward to jumping in the follow-up episode, because that's going to be where my favorite David Fincher film is, in his post-90s work. So we have that to look forward to. Where can folks find you on the internet?
Yeah, I could be found on Twitter at JRATM23. I talk a lot of boxing and movies, pretty much. Yeah, I could be found there. And I also guest on a podcast on Michael Wilson has a Pound for Pound boxing report. So I'm really into boxing and love to go see live fights and whatnot. No connection to Fight Club.
Oh, well, thank you again for coming on, and I look forward to the next one that will go along with this. And yeah, I guess until next time, I was never really here. I was just a figment of your imagination, listeners. Take care.